Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is April the 5th of 2017. It's Wednesday night. It's time to talk about manga. Isn't that right, Chris?
Yeah, it's a nationwide thing.
Nationwide. Yep. Worldwide. Universe-wide.
Yeah, there's a little goo men on Pluto. We're ready to talk about manga right now, as decreed by Universal Champion Hulk Hogan. And he's distributed that order. I don't even know what Hulk Hogan talking about manga would sound like. I assume it would be pretty bad. He didn't seem like the most...
Hogan apparently likes Kaneki Man, so...
Well... Alright, I guess there's that. I just don't think like Hogan is a literature kind of guy in any way, so I feel like even manga, he'd just be like...
It's too many ethnicities, brother.
Well, there's that. I just meant more along the line. I didn't think he'd be very interested in something that wasn't like physical in any way, so... But yeah, he also...
Will reading this get my muscles to be even bigger?
I'm like, sir, you're 70 at this point. They don't get bigger.
How many chapters do I have to read in order for my skin to get even tanner? Well, you already look like a shriveled leather raisin, so...
Yeah, I'm like, sir, you just keep spraying cocoa powder on yourself like you already do. So, Nick, I have big news.
Big news.
Big news. I am quitting my job. Bam. The thing that gets dropped has just mics. Mics get dropped. But I'm not dropping this one. This one is expensive. Well, I did. I'm leaving my job. And, I'm leaving it at a good time. There's a lot of changes that are going to be happening within the state. And I just want to tell you this quick story because this was very, very amusing to me. So they're talking about this new change that's going to be happening, basically within the state. They're going to be shifting a whole bunch of human resources employees from the different departments that exist right now and putting them all under essentially one united group. And I guess when they decided this, no one actually said these terms aloud because it started sounding very, very nerdy and strange. So the first thing they're trying to explain is they're like, okay, so this first group over here, they're going to be known as the Enterprise. A lot of people are going to be going in under that, and they're going to be kind of this collective group. But there will be satellite branch offices that are going to also be known as the Matrix. So the Enterprise will have to interact with the Matrix, and that's not even what's weird, all right? That's not even where it got strange, because those are terms I've actually heard used before within the state.
Sure, sure.
This last one, though.
Enterprise, when used in a business, absolutely. Matrix is used in many contexts. Okay.
So that one kind of worked. However, the one that made me laugh was they were like, so, obviously, there's people in the state who do HR work but aren't HR employees. You know, people, clerical, things like that, who do HR duties but aren't part of, you know, an HR position. We're going to be referring to those people as shadow people. I was like, wait, what? Shadow people? So there's going to be points where we're going to be like, so what do we do regarding this process? Well, first we have to speak to shadow people about this. And I was like, did I walk into Comic-Con? I spent the rest of the meeting just writing down various alternatives to other things. They'd be like, so we're going to be operating on standard operating procedure, or as we like to call it, our morphine sequence. And there are going to be people, of course, who are going to be out of classification working. We call those the others. I was like, did no one say these terms aloud, or was this just a brilliantly subtle way of the nerdiest dudes in the department just sneaking that shit in? How did no one think, like, maybe shadow people isn't the greatest term to use for these?
So after that, we've got to coordinate with our directors of operational management, or Doom Patrol.
There was a moment I was like, oh, I shouldn't leave. This shit's getting so nerdy and juicy. I'm only a couple steps away from becoming a Power Ranger in this, I think.
That's amazing.
They're like, we have our people, or as we like to call them, Keyblade Holders.
That sounds amazing. The only thing that happened at the last work meeting that I had to go to was that they told us how great our new vacation time was going to be.
They're like, or as you like to call them, dimensional operation periods. Like, I was waiting for the moment where they're like, so Chris, your position is what we're going to now be referring as a Stardust Crusader. Like, it's super abject terms that just keep getting added on. It was my high every time they said it, because they had to keep bringing it up during the meeting. And every time they did it, it felt like it was intentional. Like, cause they made jokes about it at first, like, yeah, these are really nerdy terms. But they'd be like, I don't know, the Matrix gonna have to talk to the Enterprise.
Now let's get serious and talk about the duties of the Shadow People. And
legitimately, cause this is a huge shakeup. This is legitimately a huge shakeup for the entire Commonwealth. And they're sitting there like, so I don't know, we're not gonna be part of the Matrix, we're not gonna be part of the Enterprise, we're gonna be some satellite within them. I don't know what we're gonna do with the Shadow People. That's something we're gonna have to put on the table. We're gonna have to address the Shadow People later. It's like, what is this?
And let's also discuss the new duties of our tech support, or as we like to call them, Cyber Samurai.
our Cybermen.
Well, you just know that the tech support guys are like going to be proposing new terms too.
Oh yeah,
adjusting their freaking anime figurines on their monitors.
If this was me, it would be nonstop adding on to this with just like an egregious amount.
I have a proposal for a new term. No, you can't be a Pokemon master. Shut up.
I'm like, I'd like to think we could rename our training programs. Perhaps we call them the Digital World, and we enter into it.
Through our digivices.
Yeah, and people within it and different, you know, entries. Those would be Digimon, if you will. So I could just have a moment where I'm just like, God damn it, Jan, I'm busy spending time with the Digimon! I don't have time for your office horseshit.
Different levels within the Digimon. I mean, obviously we start off with Rookie, but then it doesn't take too long before you can become a champion.
So I'm dealing with a real champion level problem right here, so I gotta get this handled before lunch or there's gonna be some real issues. And you know what? Based on how things are going, I feel like this would not be that hard of a change to enact.
This is the government.
I mentioned before, I recently watched Parks and Rec. And for the longest time, my association with that was like, oh yeah, it's silly how much like the government's such a character on the show. And then after working at government for so long, you're like, no, like this isn't like, it's not weird how government works in that show at all. That's exactly how it works.
Strange people.
You really do need a Ron Swanson, someone who's there like, I work for the government, but I hate every single moment of it.
Tom is exactly the kind of employee I'm looking for. He has no motivation. Never works beyond what is asked of him.
He's going to make a fine shadow person.
All right. We do have quite a bit of manga to talk about this week because we've got more of our usual series than usual to go through, as well as finally talking about Blue Exorcist, which is a suggestion we took roughly a month ago. So Blue Exorcist has been running for, what, like 7 years, I think, right around that time. Monthly series, so even though it says 86 or so chapters are out, that's much more content than initially appears.
It's about 13 or 14, volumes or so.
So, basically, very simple, because, you know, Shonen Battle series, about mostly young kids fighting demons. Yes. The premise is that there's a parallel world to the human world that demons dwell in. Demons frequently make their way into the human world, either just by invading, through like small openings between the two dimensions or through demonic possession or through summoning, all this typical things that you associate with, you know, demons invading the human world, really. And the people who fight them are called exorcists. They're called exorcists, but they don't just, you know, carry around crosses and throw holy water. Some of them do that, but they essentially pull from all of the different techniques that you associate from different cultures that have their own means of dealing with demonic possession or evil spirits. So there are people who recite verses from scripture. There are people who use like Buddhist chants. There are people who just fucking take out swords and cut them down. There are like, you know, Shinto rituals involving, you know, using like paper in order to summon, creatures in order to help them out. So it's a basic sort of, battle manga setup where there are a bunch of different techniques But the cool thing about it is that I think almost all of it does draw from, you know, things that actually exist in like religions and spiritual cultures, for the most part. And within this world, our main character is Okamura Ren, who is the son of Satan. He just is.
Which means a lot until you find out it's like 13 fucking kids. Like, it's not nearly as significant
as
it first
seems. There's a whole bunch of sons of Satan. Satan got around.
Yeah.
essentially, his mother had a relationship with a man who was possessed by Satan. And Ren is actually a twin, but he absorbed all of the demonic stuff in the womb. And so he can transform, grows. He's got, you know, sharp teeth and ears. And when he draws this particular sword that seals away his demonic half, he transforms and then he grows horns and blue flames and stuff. And that's really all you really need to know, I think, about the series in general. At the start of the series, it turns out, oh, hey, he's the son of Satan. So exorcists come along and they're like, we need to kill you. And so you've got two choices. You can either, you know, die here, or you can fight us and kill us and escape that way, and you'll be on the hunt for the rest of your life. And he's like, no, because I'm still a human. And the guy's like, I like your moxie, kid. So you got a third option, which is to join this academy to train new exorcists and just join us and be a weapon on our side in this never-ending war. And so he does that.
The first chapter for this series is actually a pretty engaging one, because it deals with having to set up this entire premise of Ren being this demon boy, the son of the son of Satan. And kind of places it all within this character who at first is such an adoptive father. Father Fujimoto, I think it is. Or Fukimoto. I can't remember his exact name off the top of my head. And it's essentially this, you know, almost a short story in a way of the sacrifice that Fujimoto, the father, is going to be making for his, you know, adoptive son. Someone who he considers a blood in every single way. That I almost thought was a little sad because he dies within this chapter. Spoilers, the first chapter. But what's kind of crazy is how much they actually build that character up through subsequent chapters after you learn not only actually how important he was after the fact, but also the different relationships and even the things he's put into motion prior to his own death. Like, it's no surprise a lot of the people that Ren meets, because a lot of them, the father basically requested to help make sure Ren would be safe in the future should anything happen. So it's kind of an interesting chapter.
Hey, if I die, look after my son. If I die, please train my son in the way of the sword. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a nice way of kind of setting up this sad figure, but doesn't just leave him as this backstory kind of character. You do actually get more about him, and it helps to kind of make that sacrifice a little bit more intense too, as you start to learn, like, oh, okay, there's a lot of things that this guy had his finger in, and, well, not that exactly way, but just that you get to see how fleshed out he was. As for the premise of this is a, you know, very standard kind of shonen premise. You know, this is probably, I guess, the battle manga equivalent of the comedy manga of the son of hell or some descendant of Satan has come to the human world and wants to know what it's like to be a human. You know, we mentioned that when Demon Prince Poro's Diaries came out. This is a premise that isn't all that strange. You know, Dee Grayman and Bleach have been the most recent examples to just kind of sit in that same kind of area of dealing with, like, the supernatural battle manga sort of thing. But I kind of like what Blue Exorcist does a lot. It's interesting to see it in a monthly manga format, and actually, it's unique because it's not unique. You would figure that for a series that runs monthly, it would move at a much different pace than a shonen manga would, but it doesn't. It really kind of just feels like it's a shonen battle manga that just fuses three chapters together and puts them out at once, essentially. It doesn't have this unique pace or do anything all that absurdly different. It kind of still gives you that same speed that you'd expect out of a shonen series, but without that notion of being like, oh, you're going to wait a month between chapters. It's like, yeah, fuck it. Let's keep this up. Let's not do anything too crazy here.
The cliffhangers are just kind of dropped out more sporadically.
Yeah. But it helps because it's not too unfamiliar to deal with. Like, if you told somebody, hey, read this monthly battle manga, they wouldn't have to adjust to much. This is very much what you kind of expect from it. And done in a way that I appreciated, because this is, beyond the premise, just the notion of what Rin is. A character with extreme amounts of power who, you know, particularly it's an evil amount of power within him that he can't always control, but he doesn't want to be defined by this evil power, has been a trope used, you know, throughout manga for basically all time. I mean, there's countless characters that kind of have this. Naruto would be the easiest one you could bring to mind, but this is something that just happens a lot in shonen manga. There was something oddly refreshing about Rin, at least early on, in just his conviction to everything and how it mixed with the humor of this series, that it didn't feel like you were just reading another variation of this. I actually kind of found myself really intrigued by it, and I think it's due in no small part to the fact that his twin brother is a major character in this, doesn't have any power, but is still much more competent than his brother in, like, every single way. So it was just an amusing relationship that got put in there and helped to kind of add a fresh element to everything.
He's got, it's established early on that, yeah, Yukio, his twin brother, has actually been training to be an exorcist for, like, his whole life, whereas until his demonic side was getting revealed, Ren had no idea that there even was, for demons in the world, he was a regular kid, essentially. So Yukio had found out about it, and he's been training his whole life in order to be able to support his brother. So he's actually Ren's teacher at the academy, which is an interesting dynamic. You know, he shows up like, all right, I'm going to learn how to be an exorcist. What are you doing here? Are you sitting here? No, I'm your teacher. And he also fights with a pair of guns that shoot, like, bullets that are, like, laced with, like, holy water or something like that.
Holy bullets, yeah, it makes sense.
Why not?
It's amusing to me because you were kind of mentioning it, like, there's various ways you can choose to be an exorcist. And there's some ways of using chants or auras to kill demons. I guess every demon has, like, a kill command, essentially, out there. And if you know it offhand, you can just chant it, but otherwise you have to go through it. And all these other forms kind of exist to kind of protect them. But there's ones that are like, oh, I'm like a summoner. I summon a demon from the other world and let them fight for me. But then there's just dudes like, I just shoot things. I shoot things or I take out my sword and I cut things. I love, like, they're just like, look. And then there's this one that's just, it's very direct. You shoot demons. And I'm like, I can dig it.
There's a really cool sequence early on in the series where the class is together. It's about eight of them in this room, and they're cornered by this demon, and they're like, okay, none of it, we can't actually fight this thing directly, but we can, you know, keep it at bay with one of the people here. And so one of the top students in the group, his name is Bon, or his nickname is Bon, says, okay, it's this type of demon, which means that the phrase to get rid of it should be in this book. And I happen to have memorized the entire thing. And his friend is like, I've memorized the first seven chapters of it. Okay. And they're like, okay, you start from chapter one. I'll start from like chapter 11 and we'll just recite the entire thing from memory. And eventually we should land on the phrase that expels it. And they just do.
It's this big tense thing of, like, the demon trying to break through their barriers to get at them, and they're just all, like, in the back, like, fucking our Father art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom, fuck, it's not working, all right, next one.
The same guy, because as part of a training arc, they have to, like, retrieve this giant lantern that is possessed by some sort of a demon, and they have to do a number of different things in order to keep it contained, one of which is one of them has to be constantly reciting some sort of prayer over and over again on loop. And so Bond does that, and he launches this entire plan for them to transport the lantern across a river. And he is reciting stuff constantly while he's just writing out the plan to people and showing them diagrams he's drawn and stuff, and he's still just talking the entire time while pointing at different things and holding up different signs. He's like, okay, now let me explain.
I am one with the force is with me. I'm not the force, the force is me.
So it is cool to see different methods like that used, and made given a much stronger emphasis on how different they are than just, well, taijutsu is you punch someone. Ninjutsu is you shoot something. Genjutsu is you use illusions. See? And that's really it.
it more falls in the line of taijutsu means you punch something. Genjutsu means you create illusions. Ninjutsu is fucking everything else.
Everything.
It's everything else. It's
clones, fire, summoning.
dimensions. Being friends acid with dogs. Dogs. Knowing dogs is ninjutsu.
Going back to Ren, I think that he was actually probably one of the strongest parts of the series. I think that he's got a very likable thing to him. He reminds me of early Ichigo in a lot of ways from Bleach, where he's this kind of troublemaking guy, but he's very serious about what he does. He's not always the smartest guy in the room. But he's very dedicated and he's got a very direct way of looking at things. And there are moments, especially early on where, they're having the bonding time between, the classmates who don't get along initially, where he learns something about someone and he just, directly addresses it. He doesn't dance around the issue. One of the major female characters in the story is named Chiemi, and she's got this, big hang up about her grandmother's garden, and her grandmother has died recently, so she feels as though she's got to stay where she is. She's got to stay in the garden. She's got to stay rooted there in order to take care of this last remaining memory of her grandmother. And this weakness allows a demon to possess her, or to possess the plants around her, which start to actually take root in her legs, which is pretty nasty. And Ren just, addresses things very directly with her. He says, hey, your grandmother wouldn't want you to do this. She wouldn't want you to waste your life. And she would and knowing what you told me about her, she would say that these are just plants. So you should, go on and live your life and actually do something that would make her proud. And, that ends up working. A lot of his advice ends up working. Mm-hmm. So despite the fact he's basically the stupidest person in the class.
Oh, yeah.
I think that, yeah, he definitely is. Everyone's got some sort of specialty that they've gained through studying, and he's just I got fire and I can cut things with my sword.
he's that guy who's there because he's friends with the teacher, essentially. His parents know the principal of the school, so to speak. But yeah, he's pretty dumb. But I agree with you completely. There is something very likable to him. I don't know, and maybe I was misphrasing myself earlier, I don't know if there's anything particularly unique to him, because as I said, the whole I have dark energy within me and sometimes I lose control, but it's not what defines me. I mean, Ichigo had the exact same thing too. I wouldn't let the inner hollow take control of me. I'm not that guy. But it's nice that everything is executed well. I think that's the thing that really kind of hits with this series and works for it, is that to all that I've read, everything revolving Rin and being the son of Satan and having these powers, it's executed well. The moments that need to be in there are, there's this big moment where after Rin kind of loses control in this one big showing, a lot of his class are infuriated, and it's kind of logical for it because it's essentially the same thing as Naruto. There was at one point in time, a giant monster or a giant attack broke out at all the monasteries around the world. It was the Night of Blue Flames, I think they call it.
Yes.
And essentially a lot of people died from it. So a lot of people have a lot of anger towards that feeling.
Including Bond's, he's got a trifecta of people who are all very closely connected to the temple where the incident took place.
Exactly. And it's nice because his grief is very understandable. This blue fire, it's the first time he's seen it since that night, so it makes a lot of sense that he has an understandable amount of anger towards Rin at first about, what he actually is, especially after they had this one big moment kind of bonding over their mutual desire to be the one that kills Satan, which in that world is considered a ludicrous notion. People are just what are you talking? No, that's, you can't do that. You can't kill Satan. So I just feel like everything in the series, again, up till what I've gotten through, is well executed on that front. And it's a sticky kind of area, because I feel like if you do it in a lazy way, or if you just don't take your time to actually build emotions to it, it just comes off cheesy. Like, you're like, oh, I want my main character to feel strong and powerful. So they have all the dark energy in them, and sometimes it makes them go crazy.
And during that whole incident where there's a fallout between Rin and the rest of the class, you know, different characters have kind of different reasonings behind it. Even the three students who are connected to the temple have different reactions to it. So there's Shima, who is this pretty laid-back guy, and he doesn't really hold anything against Rin, but his two friends do, so he's put in this awkward position. There's this really timid guy who I grew to really hate during that sequence, because it's like, God, you fucking wuss.
Grow balls!
I can't forgive you! He's like, shut up! And there's Bond, who's got the he feels like he's been slighted because, you know, this guy he made this promise with wasn't really up and up with him. And then there's Shiemi, who has the standard, why didn't you trust me with that information? And she starts to feel guilty because she feels as though she's not strong enough to stand beside people, enough for them to trust her with everything. And then there's Izumo, who's the other girl in the class. She's this, you know, like, she's very much a Miko kind of character. And to this point in the story, she's been this stuck-up haughty bitch.
Yes.
And she's the tsundere character. She had really abused Shiemi, wanting to be friends with her to just make her a gopher at first, until, you know, she was brought into, you're going to be a main character now, so you better be at least a little bit better.
Yeah, she was but super bitch at the start.
Really. And so there's this whole sequence where all these people who have been getting along with Rin are, you know, like, seeing him on a train as they're going to this, on this training trip. And they're just, you know, kind of, you know, ignoring him, giving him the cold shoulder, and sitting somewhere else on the train. And Izumo just sits right down next to him. And so Rin by this point is like, so aren't you gonna like do anything? And she's like, no, what's the point of doing that? So it's this really cool scene because, you know, the most like, I don't care about you people kind of person is also actually the least affected by this betrayal. So it's like, wow, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I do like that these casts are all given like their own real arcs that kind of are explored through this. Again, it's just this idea that everything in the series is very well executed. You could look at every one of these characters and kind of pick out their tropes, but tropes don't mean something's bad. The execution is what's important, and I feel like from all that I've gone through, most of these characters are executed really well. I think the one character I didn't have an intense fondness for is, what is her name? The chick on the title card, big booby fucking, Shura is her name. And it's not that she's necessarily bad. I know there was a very recent arc that's kind of, I think it's actually still ongoing, that deals with her very heavily. But, I don't know. She was maybe a little too much for me at the start. It was a lot of, I'm going to walk into this room, my tits are going to be hanging all sorts of out, and I'm going to be really mischievously cryptic about shit. But again, my tits be everywhere. Just like, God damn it. Also, stop drinking around children.
People are going to post me in all the image boards. It's the way that I would describe this manga, because I've been trying to think of a suitable metaphor, and unfortunately the only one I could come up with was sports related.
That works.
This manga is like a running back that has a 3.5 yard average and always gets 3 or 4 yards. Always. Not going to break out that 80-yard run that makes the highlight reel. Probably won't set any big records, but you know what? If you can get someone who gets 4 yards a carry every single time, holy shit, that's great. That's reliable. So this manga didn't really blow me away. But I like it. I like it just based on the fact that it's got solid execution. Nothing in it seems unfamiliar. Nothing in it seems surprising. And a lot of stuff you could point to another series and say, oh, it's exactly like that. So that's kind of both a good and a bad thing, honestly. I like I liked it, but at the same time, I feel like I don't feel as though there's a whole lot noteworthy from it. Nothing bad noteworthy, but nothing good noteworthy really either. It's hard to describe any like standout moments for me because it's more just kind of overall feelings that I have about certain characters.
I can agree with that. And I think the few elements that do stand apart for it are the ones I think I found the most kind of interest in. As I mentioned before, he has a twin brother whose name I don't know why I'm blanking on so freaking hard. Because I think we said it like 17 times during this, but Yukio, sorry. The fact that a brother-twin-brother relationship is one of the most forefront dynamics in this series is really refreshing. I always really enjoy it when characters bring sibling dynamics into the story. That's always something that I just have a fondness for in general. And I really like the way they played this out because they play at it at more than one angle too. Like they will show that the two of them kind of have their moments where they'll fight. Yukio, despite being technically the little brother, also kind of has to act like Rin's mom a lot of the time. Like he has to kind of be responsible for this guy who otherwise, I mean, I don't even know how he gets pants on every day. Like he's always fucking tired, he's always stupid, running late and all this sorts of shit. Like this
they have dorms at the academy, and from the very beginning, Rin is shacking up with Yukio. They share a dorm together, and it's funny because you know Yukio is Rin's teacher, and Rin will just be you know doing typical freaking teenage protagonist who goes to school antics of sitting around, slacking off, goofing around, and Yukio will be like, you have homework. I gave you homework.
You know I know I gave you homework. You know this. I enjoy
it. I'm going to know you haven't been working on it.
Yeah, when you tell me a dog ate your homework, I'm going to know it's like, one, you don't have a dog. Two, I gave you, I can see the homework right there. I saw you watching a fucking another Impractical's Jokers marathon and not fucking finishing your homework. Actually, that reminded me of another story I really liked in this. And again, it relates back to the father. There's a short story, I think like a third or so volume. Actually, I think it must have been the second, because it happens relatively soon into the story. And it deals with a familiar that exists in the world, because they explain that familiars are brought into the world by an exorcist, essentially. And then they kind of team up with it. Fujimoto is the father's name, by the way. And they work with that, you know, that exorcist, but when they die, then that's kind of up in the air. Who knows what'll happen? And that happens with this black cat named Shura or Kuro that once Father Fujimoto dies, the cat starts growing essentially feral. And it's a story that becomes like the exorcist. Like it's not a world-ending event. The exorcist community is like, well, we have to kill the cat because like it's just going to start attacking people. So they're preparing to put it down. Yeah. And Yukio even is given, like, orders ahead of time by Father Fujimoto to, like, if it needs to come down to it, use this. It's a drink. It's poison. It'll lure the cat in and kill it. But instead of letting that happen, Rin goes out, puts himself online to essentially make a connection with this cat because they're both grieving over the same person's loss and becomes friends with them. And at the end, you even find out.
Was it Rin promises that he won't use his flame till use his head? And he headbutts the cat.
he headbutts emotion into this cat, like they share their feelings for their father through a headbutt. And then at the end, it even has this nice little tie-off where Yukio, like, smells the poison that was supposedly given to him, and instead it's the same sort of catnip whiskey. Fucking stupid concept, but this catnip whiskey that Father Fujimoto originally shared with Kuro back in the day to calm him down when he was first growing kind of aggressive. And it's this very sweet, very neatly tied together story, and Kuro then becomes kind of like another character of the cast. He's essentially a familiar now for Rin. It's just a nice executed story that kind of goes to show the kind of story you'll get from this. As you mentioned, it's good. I don't know if it ever blew my mind. I don't know if there's any moment yet that I've read where I've just been like, holy crap, this is amazing. But you don't necessarily need that out of the story. It's just the fact that everything seems to be consistently good that I think is the best aspect that you're going to get out of this story.
Yeah. There is one thing that I will say. It's, I got really stuck on the first real major arc of the story, which is when they're at the Buddhist temple. Uh-huh. God, it just could not get through it. Literally, last week when, we were, when it looked like we were going to be discussing this series, I had been stuck there for a while for the several days going in, preceding that show. And so I started to, you know, skip ahead, jump to a few different, smaller stories and, went through a different arc altogether. We didn't end up doing it last week. So I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll be able to go back and finish that arc. Did not. Had an entire week to just read that arc and just like, oh, it's so boring. And no other part of the story have I ever had that reaction to it. It was just, literally just like, oh my God, I don't care about any of these stupid Buddhists.
None of these guys. Boo.
Who are they? It's a really weird one because there's this character who like betrays them and they are hinted to have betrayed the temple. Like right when they're introduced, and then it turns out that they have betrayed the temple. So I was kind of like, "All right." it's a much bigger deal when one of the characters that's actually in the class turns out to have been this undercover agent the entire time, which is handled really well because it has long-standing effects on the group. Because you know, it turns out. Oh no, he was a double agent. He really was loyal to them the whole time. But then they're like, well, you have seriously been keeping secrets from us. And by your very nature as a spy, how can we possibly ever trust you with anything? It is literally your job to act one way in order to gain secret information. And, that kind of stuff is really cool, and I think that that's really anything that deals directly with the main cast I like. Those main, I think it's, what, 7 kids or so?
Yeah, about that.
Rin and Yukio, Shiemi, Vaughn, 7. I like the stuff dealing with those 7. Honestly, a lot of the other stuff doesn't strike nearly as much of a chord with me. People apparently really like Mephistopheles, or however the hell you're supposed to say his name, because it's not Mephistopheles.
Nick, you big dummy, it's Mephistopheles.
Mephistopheles?
Oh man, this is gonna be like me pronounce that one guy's name from last week. It's like Mephistopheles. Mephistopheles.
Did not really care for him. Don't care for, like, almost any other character except for, like, Rin's father, who is dead, and then the main 7 kids.
Yeah, I do agree. I wasn't incredibly engaged with the demons, and there's another son of Satan that gets introduced very early on. It's kind of like a quasi-antagonist to them. And the politics of the school itself is something that was kind of hit or miss on. There's parts that I did like when he's like brought into like the triumvirate of the school to be faced with, like after he's revealed to be a son of Satan and how that entire thing plays out. That works, but there was like an early on character who's like,
That's a really good scene. Sorry, Jenny. I really want to cut you off. Sorry, before you move on to the next one, because there's a position that is like the top exorcist or the top knight type exorcist, which is called a paladin, which it turns out that, Fujimoto was before he died. And the new paladin is this real, you know, Knight Templar jerk. So, yeah, when Rin is first outed and he's got to stand trial, the guy, like, punishes him for speaking out of turn before the council by just taking out his sword and stabbing it and cutting his foot off. And that's probably the biggest holy shit moment I had in this entire story, because he'll regenerate it because he's got demon blood and stuff, but he just cuts his foot off with, like, no warning.
But there was a character early on who was a teacher at the school who knew about this and wanted to test him. It was kind of, like, apparently, like, a secret agent kind of working for one of the demons. And that entire character, I just did. It was weird because the way he kind of got introduced and had his engagement with Rin was while those other scenes were happening. We mentioned earlier with like them trying to figure out the incantation chant to do. So Rin's just off on his fucking own with this character I don't give a fuck about. But there's like there's awesome scenes over here going on. So it kind of balanced it out. But yeah, there were just some small elements like that that just, I don't know, I just didn't get into those parts of it as much. And I know that plays, you know, the relations these characters have play a larger part in it, because most of these characters kind of have these big arcs to go through, and there's a lot of stories of betrayal and sacrifice kind of brought into it, but some of the outside elements of it hit and miss more frequently than others.
And I think that that's what it comes down to, is I say that, you know, it feels like a reliable series because when it's got its core cast of characters and it handles what is to me the most important stuff well, then all the other stuff I can overlook or I can forgive. And I do think that the series probably falls short of being like, you know, great, because I don't feel like any real sense of intrigue at stuff that's going on in the bigger world. Whenever it tries to set all of these bigger parts into play, make it seem as though there's all this stuff going on behind the scenes, I'm like, I don't really care. So I never really get a sense of like, oh, I can't wait to see what happens next. So yeah, it is really weird, because I think that we're very much on the same page when it comes to this series. And but what it comes down to is, yes, it's good. It's really...
And yeah, it's tough to give it the highest recommendation, but I will say that, again, it does almost everything pretty good. And one thing I guess we haven't talked about, and I don't think we have much time to dig into it, but it's also a very funny series, too.
Yeah.
It's very amusing. You get a lot of... And you know what? It's also a pretty sexy series, too, if you like giant tits bouncing all over the place. You'll get plenty of that.
There's a surprising amount of fan service. There is, I think, more than one bathhouse chapter, I'm pretty sure.
There's also that one, like, training chapter that ends with Yukio Rin blowing off Yukio and Shura's clothes, except their underwear, which actually did go to prove his point. He's controlling his flame better, but it just has this really weird abrupt ending where he's like, I burned off all your clothes, except your underwear, so I'm demonstrating control.
Should note that when we say fan service, it is both the guys and girls that end up naked a lot, so there you go.
But, yeah, I think
series is written by a woman, so.
I definitely feel like I would recommend this series to people. I just don't think, you know, like, if this is your first time reading Shonen, understand there's more stuff like this out there that's probably going to be a little bit better, but it's hard to have a really big negative to say about a series that ultimately does what it does well enough to be good. You know, it's like the Jessica Jones of the series. Like, it's not great. It does everything pretty good, though. It's all right.
But it's Chris L.A. and Iron Fist. Yeah, don't worry about that.
It's not Iron Fist. It's not Daredevil season one until the last couple episodes, but it ain't Iron Fist. So you got that going for it.
It's more reliable than Daredevil season two. You know, there's no up against the headstone scene, but you know what? It doesn't descend into any of that crap with the hand.
There's no giant evil ninja pit in New York. That shit's still so dumb.
They don't pull that cock tease with Punisher at the end. Okay, what was it? I feel as though I would recommend this to someone who said, hey, so I've heard some good things about Nurarihi on Nomago. Would you recommend I read Blue Exorcist instead?
I'd say the same thing for D. Gray Man. Even though I think D. Gray Man had a few moments that were much better, it was like, yeah, but ultimately that story is nowhere near as good as you're ultimately getting at a Blue Exorcist. So yeah, do that.
All right. So, with all that said, we're going to move on then to the recap portion with manga recap, and we're hopefully not going to be here for another 2 hours. So let's start things off with My Hero Academia, number 132, The Plan. So last time we found out that, joining Midnight's crew, in investigating, Overhaul's group are going to be a couple other heroes who happen to have Kirishima and Uraraka and Asui. as their new disciples in their organizations. While that's going on, Overhaul is meeting up with Shigaraki for that meeting that was set up several chapters before. And the first few pages are Shigaraki just coming into the Shie Hasekai's underground compound, basically being a rude little shit, but hey, one good turn deserves another. You know, it wasn't like Overhaul was the most respectful when he turned up.
Yeah.
You know, but Shigaraki is doing stuff like, you know, he's kicking his foot up on the table. He's saying, oh, hey, you shouldn't scold me like you're actually my better, you know, you should ask me nicely and stuff like that. And, he says that they're not going to be subservient to Overhaul. They're going to be partners in all of this because each of them is gaining something from the other. Overhaul is gaining the name of the villain organization, and they're getting access to his plan and resources and stuff. In return for his acting this way, and also because he's reaching into his jacket, the two guys who are there to back up Overhaul suddenly jump on him. And so one of them just pulls a gun on him. The other, the little one, we find out is named Mimic, and he grows this massive muscular arm from his, like, throat.
Yeah.
In order to grab him. So, that's nasty. Overhaul kind of calls them off, and Shigaraki says that, you know, you still owe us that arm. And I was trying to figure out if he actually held out the arm before, but it was just a kind of confusion when I initially read this. He reaches into his jacket and then he holds up his arm and it's drawn differently from the rest of his panel.
Yeah. It's basically, I guess, just to show you. It's tough to tell because you're always like, well, his hand's on his face. You're like, all right, but that's a disembodied hand. He has another hand.
Right. But he's actually reaching into his jacket to reveal a dart, and he asks if this has something to do with Overhaul's plan. To where Kirishima is on patrol with Sun Eater, as well as the hero of the organization that they're working for, Fat Gum!
The BMI hero.
Yeah.
So now, if I ever decide to get really fat again, Nick, I have another character I can cosplay.
He seems to just essentially be Heroic Blob, honestly. Big guy with a lot of rebound in him. Kirishima, of course, is excited to be on patrol. They talk for a bit. Kirishima talks a little bit about his motivation, why he wants to, you know, improve himself and stand alongside his classmates, and why he wants to stand beside them. At certain points, and he wants to be able to stand alongside his classmates as equals. But then they're interrupted by a random gang running along the street, and I'm not exactly sure. Okay. That's Fakum who says that. All right. So this gang comes running along, and they're trying to get away from somebody. I don't know who exactly it is. I don't know if they've robbed someone or what.
It sounds like they just robbed something and it didn't work out for them. Like, they're just running away. It's like, oh, man.
It says someone shouts out before they show up, it's a fight, someone help. So I guess they got into a gang battle.
Yeah.
So a few of them run smack dab into Fat Gum and just kind of rebound off of it, just sink straight into him. One of them who has a quirk and he kind of pulls a little bit of a Mr. Fantastic to slim his body down and slip past him. But Sun Eater jumps in and he starts wrapping up with these tentacles that grow out of his fingers. And then he smacks him with his other hand, which grows a clamshell around it.
At first, I was like, what the fuck? He's like, what does the name Sun Eater have to do with having, like, I could turn into nautical-themed powers?
And it turns out that he can manifest parts of whatever he eats. So he's got the tentacles coming out of one hand. He's got a clamshell on the other. He's got chicken legs and wings growing out of his back. So it's pretty cool. I like the potential utility of the power.
It's such a goofy concept. Like, and I think that's what I kind of enjoy about My Hero, is it's probably the series out there, maybe outside of One Piece, that's willing to be very goofy with its powers and just still manages to execute them in a way that's exciting. Because this is a character who a lot of people were kind of like comparing to Sasuke when he first showed up. Like, the guy with like the dark hair covers his eyes, doesn't like beat around. And they've already kind of explained he's not that cool. Like, he just doesn't, like, he kind of has like a glum look because he's easily insulted. But also, like, he has such a goofy power, and it's not something that you're just like, oh, this is so silly, this is dumb. You're just like, this is so weird, but I'm excited to see how he uses this, because clearly he's a very talented character. Like, clearly he's very intelligent if he's one of the big three. So for, you know, the other two characters, it seemed to have very straightforward powers, just done in very well-executed ways. The fact that his power is like, I could turn into fried chicken! It's like, all right, I want to see how you use this shit!
So, a random guy in the crowd of onlookers suddenly pulls a gun out, and from the gun, the same dart that we saw Shigaraki handling earlier fires. And we cut back to the villain's discussion, and Shigaraki is saying, when you stuck this little thing into him, Mr. Compress was unable to use his quirk. So just what are you planning to do with these? And the same dart strikes Sun Eater in the arm. And Overhaul explains that this is to destroy the way things are. They say All for One stole quirks to gain power. I am taking that method and changing it up a bit. And we're planting the seeds of change throughout this country. Little by little, we're laying groundwork for the plan. And the guy with the gun shoots Kirishima in the head. But his skin is hardened, and so it bounces off. So, fortunately, Red Riot lives to fight another day. Not just gonna have Kirishima say, I want to stand alongside my classmates, and then you lose your quirk, bye.
I have to assume it's a temporary thing, otherwise, like, the villain association is pretty fucked, because didn't, like, three of them get hit with that, essentially? Like, Mr. Compress got hit with it, and I guess Mag got hit with it, but then died, so I guess that one's a null factor.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know, honestly, because Shigaraki doesn't really say one way or the other. He says right after you hit him with it, Mr. Compress was able to use his quirk, but does that mean immediately afterward he lost it? Or does he mean that, yeah, it was, you know, like temporary paralysis? So, I don't know. I think that it is more likely to be a temporary thing, but, given that it's, you know, just, you know, this just introduced character, who has been affected by it, maybe it could be a permanent thing.
Mm-hmm. How fucking much would it suck if he lost his powers, but he was stuck with his fucking hand as a giant clam and his feet as a fucking chicken? Like, just because he's like, oh, he didn't unmanifest those powers. He's like, I guess I just have a clam hand from now on. Great.
And, hey, maybe this has to do with, what was her name? Ray? The little girl.
So this is the plot of X-Men 3.
Yeah, like, exactly.
They're just extracting
shit. Yeah, the ability to neutralize. So oh my god, it's exactly like X3.
Oh, holy gosh, holy shit, Nick, we have to stop them. They don't know what's happening.
They're going to make a random football player play freaking Juggernaut.
What is Juggernaut, beast? Sure, though.
Oh, 6'5" Juggernaut. Who's
I'm a mutant in this version.
I'm gonna lose to Shadow Cat, even though Clausius is right over there. And doesn't say anything for some reason.
He just asks Wolverine if he wants to be thrown, and then he throws him.
Yes, online, is Rogue here? No. And he's just carrying the TV. Which, that's a scene that I feel like future generations aren't going to get. But he's carrying one of those tube TVs, like in one arm. People are like, yeah, well, TVs aren't that heavy. You're like, no, those tube TVs were fucking heavy. They were, like, filled with granite for some reason. That shit was ridiculously heavy. So that was That was kind of cool. He just didn't say anything, which was the issue.
And then he did show up at Days of Future Past to, again, not say anything, and die.
Die freaking, oh, yeah. Then he showed up at Deadpool, and he was fucking Russian and very much like, I am your father. You make sure you get proper nutrients. I was like, this is amazing. More of this.
This is the best possible Colossus.
the part where he's just like, have breakfast.
You have chance to be hero, Deadpool. Nah.
You must have breakfast and give you much protein for a productive day.
I'm like, Colossus is world's greatest boy scout.
I'm like, I love this. I need you in every X-Men movie now. It's just like, before we fight Magneto, everyone, get stretches in. Limber muscles will prevent injuries.
Colossus will fight big, burly woman and get embarrassed in middle of fight when her breasts are exposed. Colossus have dignity.
I am not monster.
Colossus will pose battle for you to but not shot. He's okay. Oh no, you pushed me instead!
Hoisted by my own petard. Also, right, somehow you are strangling me when I have no need for oxygen.
Oh no, it's time to talk about Fairy Tale. I will become easily embarrassed.
Fairy Tale, chapter 529, Teacher. And to continue with the trend, this chapter title gives us a glimpse back to the Moon Island arc, or Moon Trip, I think it was maybe called.
A.K.A. the best arc of Fairy Tale.
Yeah, immediately I was like, oh right, Gray was front and center, because he was the main fucking character of the story for a little bit, because not every story had to end with Natsu fighting the big bad. Yeah. Kind of satisfied. So last time, fucking Ichiru showed up and hit Actalogia with a ship to save the Wendy and Urza from being just killed by him. And they all boarded the ship. There's a lot that happens this chapter, but I gotta go through this relatively
quickly.
It's
mostly exposition, isn't it, though?
Yes, but there's a lot of really stupid fan service. Like, the ship turns, so Urza falls on top of Gerardo's tension, except Wendy's being crushed underneath her tits.
I did think that that was actually really funny. Like, it's that moment like, oh no, I fell on top of you, and then Wendy's just like, ugh!
And it's like, Urza! Urza! So, the mysterious character shows up, says, don't worry, Wendy, this ship was designed to carry dragon slayers in comfort. Just try to keep calm and take deep breaths. And I'm like, why? Why is there a ship built to neutralize this? Like, it was one of the at least interesting parts about dragon slayers, is they just had this innate weakness. A weakness I don't think was ever explained, like, in character.
No.
Like, there's never been a reason for them to be weak to transportation.
Up until that thing was introduced, I just always assumed that it was just that Natsu got comedically carsick. Like, I mean, they made a big thing of it when they went to, Edelus? That, you know, alternate Natsu was completely weak-willed unless he got behind the wheel of a car, because that was the main defining feature of just Natsu that got reversed. Was it done with any of the other Dragon Slayers? No. Wendy had big tits. That was her reversal.
Yeah. It was just, I always liked that idea that they had this one weakness, and this one's just like, don't worry, this ship doesn't have that, because you need to interact with me. You can't be fucking car sick. So, they explain, as we reveal who this character is. Actually, real quick first, I want to note, they try to shoot Actalogia with a cannon, and he just eats it, because it's empty.
Nom, nom, nom.
So they're like, attack with the 120mm cannons! And I'm like, wait, they have bullets in Fairy Tail?
They have guns. Just guns.
I want to be the one motherfucker in Fairy Tail. It's like, you want to know what my magic is? Hot lead, bitches! Boom, boom, boom! Where's the stupid celestial spirits now?
What's that, Natsu? You eat fire? Well, eat lead! Oh shit, Gideon's here instead. Damn it!
Oh, fuck me. Oh no, Wendy's here with her vague RPG Bucky magic. But the character is revealed to be Anna, the teacher from long ago, and also a long, what's the opposite of descendant?
Ancestor.
Ancestor. There you go. The long ancestor of Lucy and her family. And shocker, Nick, it's her, Anna, from way back when.
Oh man, that character we were just introduced to in flashback like 2 months ago.
Who taught all the characters. She was their caretaker. She taught them to read. I know you remember.
The freaking build-up that this reveal got Like, in the last chapter, you know, just showing, like, the lower half of her face so you couldn't really tell who it was. And they keep on doing that for about the first third of this chapter, and then a freaking full-page spread of her is like, you were Anna, our teacher! And I'm like, how does Wendy remember this?
And it's even, like, brought in when she explains, I was their caretaker. I taught them how to read and write. I was like, wasn't there actually, like, this scene that showed Ignell teaching Natsu to, like, write and read and things like that? Like,
No. That was before this character was
introduced. They're like, shut up. Anna's here. She's looking for a report. Doesn't everybody like her? She's, like, older chick, but she still has giant tits. Don't worry. Everything's going bad. Status quo. Let's keep to the plan.
I will hug you to my bosom and hold you for a not really socially acceptable period of time, because she says a lot after she grabs her.
Yeah.
Like,
don't worry,
there's about a full paragraph she gets to.
You see, Wendy? You see, Wendy? I was the teacher who taught Wendy, Natsu, and the other, like, oh, stop squirming. The other thing is human culture, and I tell her, stop it! Stop it! You want me to shove you under Urza's tin again? They cut away to have this scene with Lucy, like, crying about how Natsu's life is to be this book, and that's not right, and he's just a good boy, so he shouldn't deserve that. And then it cuts over to this fight going on between Xerif and Natsu, which, it's kind of weird that it's getting this kind of treatment. I kind of like it in a way, because it reminds me actually a lot of when Luffy fought Lucci, and they'd constantly jump between that and other scenes, so you just kind of got glimpses of it as that fight progressed. So, I'm kind of looking forward to seeing that. But then it cuts back to Anna, who has to explain why she's here and how she got here. And it's entirely this detail just thrust in with a lot of, like, coincidences or, like, very convenient that happened. So she sent them into the past, or she opened the entrance for them to basically time travel forward, and Lucy's mom opened the exit for them to do so. So they went through, but for some reason, when they went through, all the dragon slayers fucking shot out like they were dragon balls that just finished getting wished. They just ended up, they boom, 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 just landed in different territories independent to each other. And for some reason, Anna was like, I knew where you all were, but I didn't go and get you or tell you what was going on. I had more important things to do, like vaguely research the dead magic zone we could send Acnologia to. It's this sort of quasi-retcon that's being put into place of trying to actually add Anna's character to this story for what's only going to be an unsatisfying conclusion. She's either going to die in the middle of this or have some sort of sacrifice. At least she won't actually die, but have some sort of sacrifice in the middle of things that's not going to have a whole lot of weight, because she, as you said, she kind of just came into this within the past couple of months.
And as part of the side effect of us using the seal to get rid of Acnologia in the space between time, Makarov's back!
Oh, it's gonna fucking happen, you know it will. They explained that in the process of going through the eclipse, again, it's really vague. It doesn't say why going through it allowed her to discover this, but she just did. There is a dead zone, a space between time, that if they were to lure Acnologia into Star Memory, I'm sorry, it's not exactly the same thing that happened at the end of Rave Master. They couldn't possibly do the exact thing that happened at the end of Rave Master. If they lead Acnologia into Star Memory, space between time, that he will be nullified and they can seal him there, essentially, and that will be the way to beat him. So they have.
I mean, there's no fucking way this is going to work, right?
It might.
They're not just going to be like, in the middle of the big, we're going to go and defeat Xerifar. They're also just going to go, and while we're out, let's just get rid of Acnologia. Yeah.
Well, I don't think it'll work like that. I think Natsu, and probably Xerif as well, because I feel like they're going to give him a face turn at the end of this. They're going to work together to essentially, I don't know, like, punch him into the space between time or some horseshit like that.
But Xerif will fall into it too!
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? Well, that would actually suck, because then he has to actually live forever, I guess, too. But I feel like they're going to do something to play that into that, but this does feel like their way of explaining. Maybe there's another way around it, but for a dude who literally, like, my power is to counter magic, what can you do? I mean, I guess there's a way of him saying, like, oh no, again, like, item magic, I can't eat, so you can hurt me with that, ow! Or something. I don't know if that could work, but I don't know of another way to beat him, so it seems like this is their way of setting up his downfall. It's just the way everything's kind of handled in this is very convenient. It's very much that hero style of storytelling where it's just like, I'm here now, and when you were all sent away, I didn't have a good reason for why I didn't come to get you, and you all just pshooed away from one another when you got out. It was like that scene in Bleach where you guys got launched into the Seirete, and for some reason you got launched away from one another, and I couldn't find you. I mean, I did. I just didn't stop you from living happy lives and shit.
I mean, why would I get involved at any point? It's not like you ever needed me for anything.
Yeah, she literally explains, like, how she just hasn't bothered getting involved in the past fucking 10 years of Fairy Tail at any point. She's like, no, no, no. This is more important.
The time is not right.
I was like, God damn it! You can't all just keep explaining reasons for why none of you stopped Laxus from killing everyone in that town! You didn't all know that fucking deep down he cared about everybody!
You see, Aknalati was descending on your island, going to destroy you all, but I knew that someone else would twist you away into the future.
I knew that in the end...
everything was going to be okay.
I knew that your friendship would protect you, and that the first guildmaster was going to come to save you.
I almost stepped into action, but then you held hands in a circle.
I was worried, but I said to myself, you know what? I have it on good conscience and faith that in 7 years these characters are going to come back and we're going to have a great time. And it works out perfectly, because then you all get to catch up age range with where Rogue and Sting are.
Oh, boy.
Not a great chapter of Fairy Tail, I'm not going to lie.
All right. Let's move on to Astra Lost in Space! Chapter 28. Last time the crew of the Astra was stranded on the planet, which is no longer able to fly. And Zach sums things up very, very, very bluntly. The Astra can fly. It can fly at low altitudes and cannot go into space. And also, it is literally impossible for them to repair the damage. And so, this causes a big shock to everyone. He says, you know, we don't have tools, we don't have spare parts, we don't have a doctor repair. It is literally impossible for us to repair this ship. And so, Luca says, what do we do then? And Zach says, we don't go home. We will build a new life on this planet. All right, let's get to repopulating.
Well, just on a note, I don't want to go on too many tangents. We're short for time. But is Zach's ass distractingly flat in this panel?
Like, it's
like a moment where I'm just like, what happened to your ass? He's like, rough landing. I have no ass anymore, all right? It's gone.
Keetery really freaks out about this. She says, you know, how can you say this? You know, we've got to go home, you know, and Zach says, it's impossible. And she, you know, collapses to the ground. She starts to cry. So Zach says, I'm sorry, you know, this is my fault. If I had flown more carefully, we would have made it. Kanata's like, no, it's my fault as captain for not telling you to land sooner. He's like, you know, I really thought that we could make it. And he starts to really get bummed out. And Olgar is actually the one to kind of stop things from getting too negative because he says, hey, come on. Don't you have some sort of stupid survival tip to give us? You know, come on. You're always the one who acts strong in these cases. What, I don't know, something like you can't make progress if you're standing still. And Kanata's like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, we've got to go out and we've got to, you know, just address our current situation. We need to get supplies. We need to go foraging. It's like I always say with my survival tip, you can't make progress if you're standing still. It says the exact same thing that Olgar just said.
I loved it. I loved one that Olgar gets to have his moment where he tries to help, like he tries to lift him up. But I just love that fucking he just comes in with the same thing of just the exact same fucking
not even changing the phrasing, not even switching words around.
And it's great because it's a quote Olgar pulls out, like, don't you have some great tip? Like, I don't know, something stupid, like, if you can't make progress if you're standing still. He's like, don't worry, guys, survival tip number 10, you can't make progress if you're standing still. Like, he said it in kind of like a dismissive way, and he's just like, that was a really good tip.
I also love because they're in their spacesuits with helmets on because the atmosphere on the planet is not, they can't tolerate it. but Olgar still got his beanie on underneath the helmet.
It'd be ridiculous if he didn't. I wouldn't know who he is. I'd be like, when did Ray get into Astra Lost in Space? He's like, actually, the best survival tips are the ones that don't make sense. It's kind of an ironic humor. You wouldn't get it.
Anyway, we can get out of the situation by setting ourselves on fire.
Yeah, if we all set ourselves on fire, you'll be okay if you have your baby memories. Does everyone have their baby memories? Oh, you don't? I guess you're shit out of luck. I have a gun now. Pew, pew, pew.
It's just like a squirt gun.
It's like, real men don't use bullets. We've actually evolved past that. It's like, God damn it, I fucking hate you, Ray.
Maybe we'll get to live a little bit longer on this planet if we just cannibalize Ray.
They're like, everybody agree with eating Ray? Yes, yes, yes.
But he's just like, you shut up and eat your Ray leg.
Eat your goddamn Ray!
Maybe this will allow us to gain our baby memories.
Yeah, they're like, we're getting baby memories back the hard way by eating you. He's like, I'm not gluten-free!
So the gang splits up with Charis, Olgar, Luca, Yunhua, and Phoenicia going to gather supplies. Some of them get quickly distracted and involved in drying, the different foliage in the area. But Luca is still very much focused on, hey, we're stranded forever on this planet. And he's very much in the mindset of, how are you guys so accepting of this? It's ridiculous how you adapted to this so easily. And Olgar takes a knee next to him and says, they're just putting up a front, probably. If you don't keep moving and keep focusing on what's in front of you, the despair will swallow you whole. No one could actually come to terms with this so fast. And Luca's like, huh. So that means you're actually scared out of your mind. No! No, I'm not! It's a cool little moment. Olgar's got some... I like how there's this pattern of characters being more open with each other after they have their big opening moment. Makes sense. Phoenicia proposes that they go check out some stuff behind a cliff in the distance. And, and Char says, well, there's not really any point though. The sun never moves in the sky on this planet. So if it's in the shadows, it's in the shadows forever. Nothing could possibly be growing there. But Phoenicia says, but I can see something behind it. So they go and check it out. We cut over to the water gathering crew, which is Zach, Kitori, and Ares and Kanata. But Kitori is still on her knees crying, and Ares is distracted trying to comfort her. So really, it's just Kanata and Zach gathering the water.
Yeah, she's just in the back, like, crying nonstop, essentially. So I had an idea, a thought came to mind about things. So at this point, the characters are, like, relegating themselves to be like, we're just going to have to make our lives on this planet now. Like, this is just what we're going to have to do. And they haven't fully accepted it, and some of them are kind of just, like, begrudgingly going along. But I started thinking about it because they mentioned, like, yeah, thank God we have our suits to go along with this. And I was like, yeah, that's good. That kid's fucked, right? Like, the little girl in the group? Because she's going to outgrow her suit, like, really quick.
That's a good point.
The rest of them are all teenagers, so they'll grow, but they're not going to be growing too much more. There's probably a way that they can, like, refit the suits to still be applicable to them. But that little girl is going to be presumably growing a shit ton faster, so she'd be just fucked. That suit's not going to fit her after a while. It's going to be like a fucking Barbie doll costume, essentially.
I'd have to go back and check to see if they establish how the suits work and if they have spares or not.
Yeah.
Because I don't really remember that.
Just the thought came to me. I was like, wait a minute. Is she fucked? Like, this plan, there's no one bringing this up. She's screwed if they try to just live here.
So, Kitori, is starting to kind of lash out at this point. And, Zach says, come on, we've got to concentrate on surviving. And she says, well, what's the point of even bothering to try that? I mean, there are so many things I wanted to do. And it starts off very selfish and vain and bratty. And she says, I want to eat good food and wear fashionable clothes. But then she quickly moved on to say, I also wanted to go to college and become a doctor and get married. And so it's very much, you come to understand she's not having this very instinctive gut reaction. Like, this sucks. I want to go home and kick my feet and just get a mani-pedi and No, she really is absorbing the full consequences of what's going to happen to them. So that sucks. Zach then says something that is somehow even colder than what he's been saying to this point. Well, first off, because Kitri says, how is it possible that you could be so cold and logical about this? And Zach says something very revealing, which is, that's what I'm supposed to do. The more panicked and confused everyone becomes, the more I must stay calm. So, that's pretty cool.
It's very good advice to have, because in a situation of crisis, you do need somebody who, even though they're affected by the situation the same way, can't be the one who gets very emotional about it. So, I really like that kind of scene from him.
And he's also continuing to push this. It seems as though the story arc is going to be heavily involving Zach this time. So he says something very cold, honestly, which is, there is actually, you could wager your life on one slim chance. See, there is one fully functional cryostasis pod on the Astra. An old model, but theoretically capable of preserving a human in stasis indefinitely. That gives one of us the chance of sleeping in the pod until rescue comes. And so, I mean, they're like, so we would just wait for rescue? Yeah. You could be waiting for a really long time, and you would outlive the rest of us because we would grow old and die while you'd stay in there. And then maybe you would be here forever. Because who knows if anyone's ever going to come to this planet after us and discover us. But Kitori just immediately says, like, that's just like you telling us that one of us should just give up and die. And Zach's like, well, if you're determined to return home, then that's your only chance, and I can't think of any other options. And Kitori's like, you shut up, and starts freaking out again. I don't want to be alone. How could you possibly think that I would want that? Which I do really like from her. That, you know, she's very much just despairing and not really doing anything else, but this option presents to her, and she's like, no, I would never do something like that. Right away, doesn't even consider it.
I like Zach, though, a lot in this, because he has this line afterwards where he's like, then let's live on this planet together for everyone. You know, his way of basically being like, alright, so you realize the gravity of the situation, so get your shit together now. But I like that he presents this option, because it's very much in character with him. She's like, is there no way to get out of this? He's like, no, there is. There's a very slim chance. It would basically require you abandoning, like, only one person could do this. The chance of even happening would probably mean that you would outlive all of us, because the rest of us would die of old age. But there is a very slim chance, and here it is. And she's just like, why the fuck would I ever do that? He's like, because you asked if there was any other way, and I gave it to you. So now that you realize we're shit out of luck, get your shit together and start getting ready to live on this planet. I was like, I really like this from him. It felt very in character, and I like the way he's kind of thinking logic through with this.
So while they're doing that, of course, that leaves Kanata and Ares off kind of half-watching what they're talking to each other about. And, you know, they talk about how Ares asks how Kanata's handling things. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, I still haven't really given up hope. I've still got that slim thought in my mind that, you know, maybe if we can make some tools here that over like the next decade, we could eventually repair the Astra and get home that way, you know, just kind of keep on working at it. And, Ares says, I wouldn't really mind that as long as you were there with me. And Kanata goes, huh?
Say what now?
And Ares starts to repeat herself, and she's blushing while she gets ready to say, and turns out Kanata's just hearing something over the intercom. Did not hear it at all, because of course you fucking didn't. So they're being called over by the other group, who of course went behind that cliff, and we find out, to everyone's shock, that there is another Astra resting behind the cliff. So, some other ship with some other crew landed here before them. Dun, dun, dun.
This is quite the twist to it. It's kind of convenient this happened, or not convenient, but coincidental this happens in the same week as another chapter that happens, where it's like, oh, okay, I guess everything's working out for you guys rather easily. it's curious. I'm really... Maybe this is as easy as that, but... it feels like there has to be something to this. Some element we're not quite getting yet. So we're going to have to see. But this is definitely an intriguing twist. I didn't imagine they'd be stuck on this planet and that the rest of the story would just be them, like, trying to survive. But what's the catch to this or something like that?
Presumably they're going to have to do some sort of work, carry parts from one to the other or supplies from one to the other or something like that. But obviously the immediate implications are, okay, yes, this is going to allow them to have a means of getting off of the planet. But what's this ship doing here? Are they the only, group that has been, marooned out in space like this, or has the same thing happened to another group of kids before, for example? Very much a little intriguing cliffhanger there. Excuse me. So, with that done, let's move on to Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma, the one where we find out where that guy that Nick insisted on saying that he thought was a girl is very much definitely not. That chin, man. the 3-on-3 contest between Central and the Resistance is continuing. We start off with Soma and Kinokuni going against each other, and Ishiki just comes over to Soma's counter and is just watching him, and Soma's like, shouldn't you be cooking too? And Ishiki's like, I'm done, waiting for the coals to heat up, and I want to cheer you on. And he goes into this big, like, reminisce with me on the time we spent training on Moon Shadow. Remember our glorious days of fun and friendship. And Soma's like, yeah, all right, senpai, let's do it. And Megashima's like, what the fuck is wrong with
you? What are you doing? You guys are idiots.
So we're then introduced to...
Nick, come up with...
Julio Shiratsu.
Don't give him that name. Nick, what's the most jobber name out there you can think of? Like, Dolph Robinson, or just a name that immediately you're like, nope, you're not going to win.
Simon Gotch at this point.
Like, Dirk Mortensen or something. Like, Dirk needs to be the first name. Like, Dirk, what's like a very common name? Hoffman. Dirk Hoffman. He's Dirk Hoffman. Super legitimate contender to the IC Championship.
Johnny Local.
Johnny Local, he's exactly. Johnny Local demands that Ishiki get back to their battle.
Get back in the ring! So, it's this guy who's got this long blonde hair and the ugliest fucking face. His eyebrows, his nose, his chin. It looks ugly. So ugly. The ugliest guy in this series. Apparently, his specialty is pepper, I guess? Eel, maybe? I don't know. Because the crowd are freaking out after he gives this big speech of, a cooking is not about what a chef puts on a plate. Every aspect of what we do in the kitchen is part of our culinary artistry. We ourselves are part of the art that we create. Face me. Let us make art together. You and I, we can make something magnificent. He takes up these two pepper grinders and starts to twirl them around in his hands and winks. And Ishiki's like, who are you again? He's part of the new council of Den, and Ishiki doesn't even know his name.
You couldn't have jobbed this dude any harder right off the bat, too.
They're having a battle of the eel, and so Julio is so upset that Ishiki doesn't even know what his name is, that he's just kind of like staring at him while everyone's cheering him on, and the rest of the council, of course, watching the contest. Tsukasa's like, oh, Julio doesn't seem so good. If that happened to me, I'd be in a depressed funk for at least 3 days. I couldn't handle it. And people are like, yeah, but everyone knows who you are, Tsukasa. That would never happen to you. And Rindo starts to scold Ishiki. He's like, how could you treat him that way? What, at least remember your classmates' names. And Ishiki is just like, hey, Rindo, you look really nice with your hair in a ponytail like that. And Rindo's like, oh, thanks. Immediately starts being mad. So Ishiki starts going at it. And it's like, oh, he's seasoning it with thick chunks of salt and pepper. How debilitating must it be for you to have to declare your specialty as I season things with salt and pepper?
You're like, that thing that they mentioned in Dr. Stone is like the dumbest and easiest way to make food taste good. I'm assuming his specialty is actually meant to be Italian cuisine with this Rondo style, because he then does like a white wine like Rondo where he's like dazzling them with his skills. But the way he's kind of described initially, and they put a big emphasis into him seasoning things with salt and pepper, does seem like pepper's his specialty. And if that is, holy shit, this was just fucking,
Hayama.
Well, I'm just trying to remember, this is, Sakuda, the mangaka behind this. This is him just being like, I'm out of good ideas for a specialty.
That's like, yeah, he's on the council, why not?
He's like, ah, shit, this specialty is, food. He's really good at making food or something.
Anyway, here's Jake Local's special technique, the 10 punch in the corner. Who could possibly counter this amazing technique?
His finisher, a running bulldog. Like when they used, like when all the divas used to have like the X Factor as a finisher. You're like, God, this is so unexciting.
All of them. Oh man, so. Yeah, people are reacting like, oh yes, this is his technique and so on and so forth. And Aldini is like an Italian opponent with another theme ingredient of eel. Yeah. This may be a tougher contest than we thought. Because see, Japanese people find it surprising, but eel is a common ingredient in European cuisine, so it will turn out really good. And people are like, oh yes, Juo Shiratsu. He has a great amount of experience and confidence in making eel dishes. On the other hand, Satoshi Ishiki is just now finishing getting his coals ready. How can he possibly face a chef of Julio Senpai's caliber? So all of a sudden we cut over to the cage and Alice is in there. And she seems far less perturbed to be in the cage than literally everyone else in there.
You'll notice that when they had all the reactions of characters, like, holding against the bars, like, what is happening to us? That, like, the cool characters weren't shown in that. So they didn't show, like, Kurikiba and Hayama and shit, like, standing there like, oh! Because they're like, it's a fucking cage. Let's, like, focus on things right now, guys.
Kurikiba, yeah, we see him, you know, chilling out, and he's, you know, just his usual, you know, headbandless self. You're like, eh, yeah, okay. So, they ask Arina, like, oh, you know, what kind of chef is Ishiki? Because we don't know him really well, and the people who know Ishiki from Polaris are like, oh, he's really dependable. You know, yeah, he does that nude apron. He's really nice. He's mysterious. That. He never talks about himself. Don't really know anything about him.
And then there's that nude apron. And Alice is like, oh, they just have to tell me anything. But what's this nude apron they keep talking about? Like, oh my God. You know what needs to happen, Nick? Somehow, a scene needs to happen where Alice is having a conversation with Ray from The Promised Neverland.
So what's your specialty? Like, I have my baby memories.
I have many specialties. If you're asking for what my most notable one is, it would have to be that my baby memories are all intact.
Well, I don't really know how those would help us out in this situation, but anyway.
But like totes but goats, that's super cool. He's like, I know it's cool because I invented cool. I actually call it rad now because cool is a little cliche. Like, oh my God.
Soon I'll move up to gnarly.
I take old lingo that isn't being, I use hand-me-down lingo and I fucking make sure. Oh, so the no impression of him going after hand-me-down lingo.
I use lingo that's retro before it becomes retro in the mainstream.
I do all my verbal shopping at the Goodwill store, so I take my hand-me-downs and I make them cool again. I'm kind of like Macklemore in that way, if Macklemore wasn't mainstream.
So Kurikiba talks about, they say noodle chefs have the 3 days for the knife, 3 months for the pin, and 3 years for the bowl. There's a similar saying when it comes to cooking eel. 3 years for skewering, 8 years for filleting, a lifetime of grilling. Like, that's amazing. He's like, oh yeah, see, if Ishiki, you know, has a specialty, you know, the kind of skill it takes, do you know the kind of guy Ishiki has? Ishiki before is like, hey, I've got an idea. Meanwhile, Ishiki is like, oh, wait, I've got an idea. If we lead this team Shokugeki, we could start up our own eel farm. I hear there's a method for raising the eel fingerlings in tanks kept in the greenhouse. Supposedly, the greenhouse just goes into this long tangent and is like, yeah, I've got this great idea for an eel farm now. Julio's like, oh, I had such great respect for you. How dare you defy Dina Zombie? You fool! You're a fool if you can't see the greatness of this. A great, irredeemable fool! And Ishiki's just kind of wiggling an eel in his head. Doo, 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 doo.
No, he just doesn't give a fuck, and the eel's just like, please just kill me!
Don't kill me, please! So, Julio is so upset that Ishiki's not engaging with him that he's like, Kinokuni, say something! Tell him he's a reject! A reject from the prestigious Ishiki family! And Ishiki's like, huh. Wasn't that a nasty insult? I guess it is true, though. Not much I can say about it. And Julio says, oh, you smile and shrug even that off. Do you have no pride, sorry. Skipping class to mess around in that measly garden. Getting kicked off of the council. Doesn't that shame you at all? And that place. Polaris, hang around with those hooligans. That dump has ruined you. I'm telling this for your own good, Ishiki. Someone with your high station has no business associating with the likes of those commoners. And Ishiki suddenly stabs the eel through the head. And like, Shiratsu, was it? Shut up for a moment. And his hand moves in a frickin' blur and peels the eel immediately. It's actually a really badass frickin' full page spread because just the blur of motion and the look of confidence on his face.
This is like one time where it's the active use of white that is brilliantly adding to a scene. You know, like there's these moments in Bleach where like there's no background, but it's a moment here where there is literally nothing put into the background aside from Ishiki and the eel. Like, they don't even bother showing the desk because that's not important. Like, what's being emphasized here is just how crazy intense this guy's motion just was.
The motion of his arms, the garb that he's wearing, he looks like a freaking samurai, like, drawing his sword.
Yeah.
There's this cool moment because, like, it peels off and then a moment after it's been peeled off, then the blood vessels in the eel burst and you see them starting to cloud. And Kurikiba, who of course is the big fish expert, is like, it's like the blood vessels didn't even realize they were cut and it took them a second to bleed. Sometimes Shokugeki no Soma just has that really cool thing, you know, just like, it's rare that it's actually, like, a cooking technique is demonstrated so badassly, but damn.
It
really liked that moment.
Awesome.
And so Ishiki, you know, points over at Julio and he says, it's one thing to insult me, but to hear you speak so poorly of my doormates, you know what? Yes, I think I will crush you.
All right. So you know what, Nick? My earlier prediction...
So he's getting the chokeslam ready.
Yeah. My earlier prediction of him jobbing in this match unintentionally, I don't think that's going to be true. So I think they might win 3-0 on this. Unless Mega Shiba just really shits the bed against the other fucking Joe local.
I was actually undercover working for the other team this whole time.
I'm still on the council, bitches. Preparing to...
Yeah, Jake Loco looks screwed, but maybe Jane Loco will win.
Julio Loco.
God. What, isn't that how you say local in Espanol? No, it's not. Oh.
Locos de Julio, I'm sorry.
Alright, let's go through Robot Laser Beam really quickly. It goes about as you would expect from the setup in the last chapter, with Yozan believing that Tomoyo was the one who was driving balls really well when it really was Robo. He's like, you should have a match against me. And Tomoyo's like, oh my god, he sees potential in me, this wonderful young pro. Because Tomoyo's an idiot. Robo somehow ends up getting roped into it. They don't even bother to establish how he was convinced to come, because they just kind of show up at this awesome course that Miura has access to, and Robo's just there, and he's like, I don't know, how did he convince you to come? You knew where he was going this time. So Miura drives a ball for his first shot, hits it really far. Tomoya's like, that's amazing. And he's like, what are you talking about? There's no way I would go on the first hit. Going his full potential. Tomoya drives the ball. He's absolute crap at it. And Miura's like, I've made a horrible mistake. I'm sorry. You can just go home. I'll just play by myself. And, I like how he's kind of almost kind about it. He's apologetic, you know?
Yeah.
And he realizes he's made a mistake and he should have confirmed it before dragging them out here. Oh, you've disappointed me. He's like, okay, I was wrong. Sorry. That's kind of cool, honestly.
Yeah.
A little change to the formula.
He's actually crying a little bit.
Yeah. Because he's so disappointed that he hasn't found someone to challenge him that, he actually tears up a little bit. He's like, oh, I'm sorry I got carried away. I was so hopeful that I could go up against someone like that. You know, I want to meet the person who had that wonderful drive, and I want to play against them, and I want to beat him. And while this is going on, Robo's thinking to himself, I don't really get it. Why is he so passionate about wanting to challenge himself by challenging this guy? Tomoyo, of course, quickly realizes, hey, were you, Robo, like, at the driving course before me? Yeah. Yeah, he's the guy with the really good drive that you heard. And, after hearing what Miura said, Tomoya basically agrees to go up against him. There is a cool little moment where he gets a pitching wedge out and he knocks a ball very precisely over towards Miura when he asks him to do it. I think that this is probably the best chapter of this series so far. It's still very much, it's kind of by the numbers, but that helps really to stand the most interesting character in the series that we've met to really stand out. So.
Yeah, I it's a disappointing thing that it ends here because this is probably the most I've wanted to see another chapter of this. It's kind of almost like Blue Balls. Like, it's like, hey, we're about to see the two best characters we've seen in the series have a match. Oh, fuck it. The jump starts over. But yeah, like when you first brought up, like, we're going to do Robot Lex Laser Beam, my first thought was like, maybe they talk about football in this chapter. I've tried to get into it. It's still just not as serious. I mean, this is probably the closest it got, but even then, I still just, I just can't get into it, for a couple different reasons. But hey, I still know that a lot of people did enjoy this series, and this is the most important thing, guys. Jump just recently put up a poll or, their survey this week asks for everyone to rank their top fives or their top series of the jump starts to put them in an order that you enjoyed them, at least the top four that you have. So that may play a part. I know that I think they said one of the jump starts is going to be in the magazine next week. It almost sounded like they'd already decided for the podcast I was listening to. But since they put out this poll, I imagine there may still be some discussion going on, or at least they want to gauge and maybe other ones will come in there. Regardless of what happens, if you want to put your opinion out there for what series of the jump starts you really enjoyed and would like to see more of, voting in the survey this week is going to be the most significant one. This is kind of where you really need to put your opinion out there. You know, don't put honey mustard as the answer. Although I heard they actually finally brought that up this week in the podcast. I didn't get to the end yet, but I guess they got a question of like, why was your last question about honey mustard? They're like, well, because so many people answered honey mustard in the survey poll, we decided to ask a question where that could be an answer. So don't do that. But vote for your favorite jump starts, because that is a very significant thing. And we want you to basically get out there and make your opinion known. So please, please do so.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get more of the adventures of Taiju and Senku.
I don't want to push anyone in a particular direction.
I am.
I'm just saying, the cool people, they vote for Dr. Stone. It's just, it's what the cool people do.
Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah. Don't you want to be cool guys?
Yeah, I'm like, what are you guys, losers? So I'm just mainstreaming heroin. I'm like, don't you want to be cool like us guys? Oh, yeah, look at that sweet burn.
All right, so we'll move on from Robot Laser Beam to one that we can get through even more quickly than that, because nothing happened in Promised Neverland that was important. So, yeah, the fire kills everyone, next chapter. So, Seven Deadly Sins, you ready to talk about this one, Chris?
Yeah, well, let's dig into it, Nick. Promised Neverland, shit happened. Don't worry about it.
All right, Promised Neverland, well, shit, didn't see that coming. Chapter 33, Action Part 2. So, you pointed out something that, really got your attention, Chris, that happens in this chapter.
Yes. So, I mentioned this on Twitter. This is the first time in the series that we have, in any long-standing kind of way, seen inside Mom's thoughts. She is, for the most of the series, been someone we saw speaking, but not knowing her thoughts. We didn't see any of her inner monologues. We were always kind of following Ray, Norman, Emma, Chrome for a little bit of time. But it's very significant that we never saw Mom's thoughts because she knew too much, essentially. You know, if you've read the Game of Thrones books, you know there are point of view characters. And specifically, George R. R. Martin has said there's certain characters he could never make point of view characters because they simply know too much. And right. It would take away from the story. So the fact that Mom is having this little sheet, we're seeing the story in this chapter mostly from her thoughts, is very significant. This is important because there's a good and a downside to this. On the good side, this really shows how significant things are and how much the characters kind of, like, how she just got screwed over by what happens here, like how this defeated her. But the downside to this is now that we've seen it, they can't go back to just hiding things from us like this. Like, Mom's never going to have that same mystique again. So this is a very significant chapter of The Promised Neverland in general for more than just this reason. There's a lot of great narrative potential that comes from this, but it's also come at the cost that you cannot do this shit again, as we'll get to at the end of the chapter.
At first, she doesn't really reveal too much, honestly, because, you know, she's thinking to herself, tomorrow is Ray's shipments, and how long has it been since I shipped one out at maturity, and it's the meal for to be offered at the Tifari. I cannot make any mistakes. So she's like, okay, well, it looks like things are good. If I can just make it to tomorrow, I won't let my guard down, and I'll make sure I'll stay awake all night just to be safe, because I'm right here. I'll make sure that everything's okay. But then she hears, you know, Emma screaming. She follows the sound and, you know, opens the door where Ray set the fire, and of course everything is burning. It's a huge, wonderfully drawn image, honestly, that you could do, like, the black and the white contrasting for the smoke and the flame. Looks really cool with Emma in shadows and on her hands and knees in front of it. So, you know, Emma, of course, immediately writes, like, Ray's in there! Ray's in there! And so I always say Rebecca when I'm trying to say Isabella's name. I don't know why it is.
Well, that's because Rebecca seems like she's going to be an important character, but she's not, Nick. Don't worry about it. She's never going to be an important character.
I think that it's just, it must be that they must have entered into my mind at around the same time.
It's also because I think they're names with very similar kind of feelings to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very similar cadence to say Rebecca, Isabella.
So, anyway, she immediately thinks, you know, is this some sort of plan for them to escape? Yeah, but she's like, no, no, the way that she's acting, the smell. But to confirm it, she checks the tracking device, and yeah, there is a signal right in the middle of the flames. So she's like, this is not a scheme. No, Ray is in there, and he's burning, and I'm going to lose him. And so she immediately realizes this is retaliation. He's, you know, he's doing this just as his last moment of resistance, but I can't do this. It's going to happen. You know, tomorrow's shipment is happening. The Defari is happening. I can't lose it. So, all right. I'll extinguish the fire. I have to rescue him, but I've got to make sure the other kids are okay. So, of course, kids come down the stairs because there's the fire. So she calls over to Gilda and says, take everyone outside and get the babies in my room. And so the children start running away while she's rushing around, grabs a fire extinguisher, rushes back, and starts to extinguish some of the flames. Well, she commands Emma to stay behind her, but she realizes that the fire extinguisher, no, there's too much flame at this point, and why aren't the sprinklers working? Did Ray do something to them, too? The fire extinguisher's not going to be enough. I've got to open the fire hydrant, and she shouts out to Emma behind her, you need to get out of here, too! And Emma's already gone. And she's like, she checks the tracking device, and she sees a tracking device around the corner, and she's like, okay, she's nearby. Maybe she choked on the smoke and collapsed. She goes towards the signal, but she doesn't see anyone in there. She goes into the bathroom, and she looks down, and there's an ear lying on the floor. And then she starts to realize, wait a minute. She was, and all the kids were, all of them were wearing shoes.
It's the moment that's so fantastic is you see the bloodshot appear in her eyes where she's like, those fucking kids!
So Emma is running away to join all the other children, clutching her partial ear, and she says, hey, thanks for waiting, everyone. And it's not just Don and Gilda and Ray there, but all of the kids. And she's like, okay, let's run away. And they're all like, yeah. And Ray is just clutching his ear in shock. And then we get the flashback to explain what the fuck just happened. So Ray was going to set himself on fire. That was not part of a scheme. He really was going to kill himself. But Emma lunged for her and she caught the match. And Ray's like, what? And Emma says, I have a message from Norman. You can die anywhere. It doesn't have to be here. I'll show you something cool, so just shut up and come. And she says, yeah, he actually knew that you would do this. Norman knew everything before he left, and that's why he told me to stop you. Sorry, but I have no intention of letting you die. I and Norman and everyone else won't let you die, ever. And Ray's like, what do you mean everyone else? And they told the other kids, or at least some of the other kids, and they're in on the plan. They've got supplies with them. They brought shoes for Ray, and Emma says, I'll explain later. Everything is exactly as Norman planned. We're escaping, Ray. Shit.
So, last time I kind of mentioned, like, it was a chapter you didn't know how to react to. Like, I couldn't tell you if it was a good chapter because it was just flabbergasted by it.
And I'm sorry, I just got in the chat. Phil is dead. Emma took care of the final traitor.
It is notable you don't see Phil in that.
You don't see Phil.
Although, oh man, I feel like I'm going to sound really racist if I say this. Does the one black girl not look a little bit like Crone? Maybe it's just the fact that her hair. It's the hair that kind of gets me on that. But we kind of did mention before, all the moms have kids. I don't know, just a weird thought out there. Like, I feel like the other kids that don't have names aren't very significant, yet this is a page where we kind of establish, like, here are a bunch of the fucking kids. And there's one who looks like he's fucking the richest little pompous dickhead in the top left-hand corner, and I hate him, and I want him to die first.
I don't know, the guy, the pointy-haired guy with the weird eyebrows is the one that's drawing my attention. The one who shows up with the supply is the blonde one.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you don't mean like the fucking, the guy that's like right on top of Krillin down there in the bottom right hand corner? I mean, Krillin with hair?
No, I mean Onion Head next to him.
So this is a very interesting chapter, and much in the same way, I don't know how to feel about it quite yet. This is, I feel like, a very exciting twist. It feels like this is a series where every character is Haruma from IHL 21. Everyone knows exactly what everyone else is going to do, and you just don't know the depths of it yet. Because apparently, you know, I mentioned before, I don't think Norman's dead. I don't think that was given the kind of build-up that felt like the appropriate thing. We still don't know if he's alive. I think he probably is, but they don't confirm in this chapter, but they do confirm that Norman planned a lot of shit out before he went away. So much so apparently, he apparently knew that Ray would try to at least kill himself before things happened. So there is that. And I do like that we saw this vulnerability from Mom. That is intriguing to me and very unique. However, while I like this twist, this is something I feel the Promised Neverland can do once. Because if they pull this again, then it's going to be frustrating. Once is cool in like a, you know, unique moment. But if the twist again is it looks like the characters just got killed or killed themselves. But oh no, it turns out that was all part of their plan. And we just kind of misled you to believe that someone had just been killed. Then it's going to be frustrating. So I can't fault the manga for doing something it hasn't done. And I have enough faith in this team that this is going to be executed well and have good ramifications. It still has ramifications. Two characters lost their ears in this.
Yeah.
And they look, things can't return to normalcy from here. They can't, like, if this plan fails, they're not going back to the house and just living on shit as per normal. So, you know, shit's in motion. But it is still something to remember, like, this is a trick that really can't work if you do it again. So I'm hoping for the best out of this. I enjoyed this, but I can see why a lot of people right now are kind of annoyed by it at the same time.
I mean, I really liked it. The way that I see it is that, cause you would think that, you know, cause the last few weeks have been building to, okay, they are leaving the compound. They are escaping. So the conclusion that you have to really draw from that is, okay, well, I mean, once this escape is complete, and it's almost certainly going to take a few more chapters for them to actually get away. But when that happens, then you've got to assume that, okay, well, then what happens next? You know, we don't know anything about the outside world. And that begins the next part of this story. So, yeah.
I like to think Ray cut off his ear, and then after Emma cut off hers, he's like, I was cutting off ears before.
I was trying to her.
I kind of established a trend of losing my ear to distract Mom from the true plans of what was going on, but, you know, whatever.
Actually, you did that because we told you to. Well, you would have thought of doing that plan earlier.
Yeah. I thought of it with my baby memories before you guys did. I just didn't bring it up because I didn't want to make you sad. The one thing that was interesting to me, though, because that was the plot point in this, that they dismembered themselves. They both cut off their ears to distract Mom. We still haven't, and I wonder if it's going to be a fake gun, but we still haven't seen the Chekhov's gun, essentially, of the nullification device that they were meant to use on the ear. So I'm curious when that's going to, or if it will, play into it. I'm also really excited to see Mom's reaction to this, because even though I feel like she was beaten here, they've built Mom up to be a threat that I can't imagine this is where she's like, ah, drats, foiled. Like, apparently Grandma had enough faith in her that no matter what would happen, Mom would be able to handle it. So I'm expecting a lot more from her.
And also we've got to establish, hey, you know, how the hell did Norman communicate this stuff to Emma? Because when Norman was going to be leaving, she was trying to stop him. And we saw inside of her head that she was legitimately trying to stop him and just doing everything that she possibly could with what limited, you know, mobility she had to do it. So it looked as though, because there's a little flash at the very end of the chapter where you see Norm with the whatever pen thing and also like a letter. Maybe he just hid some sort of note somewhere for her. But I'll have to see exactly how this all went down.
Yeah.
All right. Seven Deadly Sins.
Yes, so Seven Deadly Sins, chapter 212, The Gift. So we are back in the flashback now. Not the flashback within the flashback, the proper flashback time jump backwards thing. Where we are now meeting Gother and Gother. So we met the Gother, the real one, the one who's in a wheelchair, and he's basically there with the doll Gother that we've come to know. And he's trying to explain things, but because they're both Gowther and he's talking through them, he's like, well, that's annoying. Turn off! And then he just turns the fucking doll version like, row. And he basically explains how, what he's been doing, why you've kind of been doing these different acts. And he's like, oh, well, I find humans to be revolting and I have no intention of hiding it. But essentially, you know, King's like, how could you be doing this? You've taken advantage of so many people just to buy time for you to escape from jail. How many people had to die for your personal freedom, Gowther? And he explains that his goal is to be a free man and to end this holy war. So King's like, fuck you, let's go. Diane's like, actually, I'm going to stay around to talk to him a little bit more. And it is a little bit of a nudge to the fact that he could pick up that she does have true feelings for him. The fact that his commandment isn't set off is kind of indicative of that, and that he thinks it's how great how neither expect anything of one another but give freely. I'm envious of this, and if all races could get along the way you do, there wouldn't be a holy war. But he believes that there is a way to bring this war to an end, and that it will require some kind of a sacrifice from himself. He doesn't really explain much, but he mentions that this is going to be where he's going to disappear from here on in. So he brings Gowther the doll back up and says, you know, explains it to him. He's like, I'm not going to be here anymore, so you get to live according to your own will. And even though you're a doll, you are not just a doll. And I gave you the greatest gift of all, the magic of heart magic. You will have free will and the ability to make your memories. But he asks Diane one thing. And he says, I ask a favor of you. When you return to your world in the future, please be Gowther's friend. And guide him down the right path so when, you know, he loses his way, he can be found back to that. And this is actually kind of a very heartwarming moment because this is one of those few times I feel like time traveling has actually been really effective to the story. This is meant to be them kind of explaining Gowther, yeah, like we're acknowledging Gowther's kind of a shitty person. Like he kind of does douchey, shitty things. And the creator behind Gowther is like, I need you to be there in the future to be his friend and guide him on the right path because he can do a lot of good. So Diane basically says like, yeah, absolutely. Let's shake on it and yeah, shake on it and let's, you know, see you in the future. So he says, accept my gift, my kind hearted. It's a gift of thanks from both Gowthers. And I imagine this is probably him giving Diane back her memories. It's not clear because we cut away from that and we cut back to King, who's like, man, I can't believe Lo would betray us. This is so stupid, but hey, I just need to make sure Gerard's safe. I mean, of course she will be. She's alive in the future. Why wouldn't she be fine here? And then he shows up and, it looks like she's been torn in half. I don't see legs anymore. I just see a bloody torso and yeah, actually no, I can see a dismembered leg. So yeah, she definitely has been.
There are legs over on the ground there. Yeah.
She has definitely been torn apart. So, that logic.
Well, now we know why she's, you know, kind of cloaked the way that she is. Apparently she got really fucked up and,
Yeah, I love that logic of just like, she'll be fine. She's alive in the future. What's the worst that could happen? It's like,
She doesn't have wings in the future.
Oh, right. So much bad stuff happened.
It's a very brutal shot to end the chapter on, I have to say.
It is. For a chapter that was otherwise very heartwarming. That is definitely a brutal way to kind of put it to an end, but effective.
My hope from this is that we'll start to see, you know, more positive changes in Gowther. You know, the last chapter we had that was the cutaway in order to provide, you know, what happens in between this moment and the present timeline was definitely a step in the right direction and gave me hope that that could possibly happen. And now that they're saying, hey, you know, he needs guidance in order to get better, then it seems like there's a follow-up on that. So. Yeah. Good stuff.
Liked it a lot.
Alright. So, let's move on to Black Clover.
Are we jumping over Boruto? I mean, we're short on time.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
We're short on time, so we probably really don't have much
Boruto's an idiot?
All I was going to say is that I made a comment on Sarada's fucking footwear choice bothers the shit out of me, but she does kick a tremendous amount of ass in this chapter. Like, she's essentially the Sasuke of this group, apparently, because she just whoops, like, fucking three of the dudes and just solos them.
The only thing that's really notable about it is that apparently Boruto is getting his Konohamaru character in this, except he's a rich and tile douchebag, so that's really it.
Yeah.
Black Clover, page 104, the Briarmaid's Melancholy. So, last time, Charlotte, the captain of the Blue Rose Knights, randomly showed up at the festival. She dispatched some guy who was trying to hit on her. And it looks like she's going to crush him to death with her vines. Yeah.
He deserves it. Fuck that guy.
No one really stops her?
No.
At all?
It's interesting that Asta's trying to say, like, hey, stop it. He looks like he's going to die. And I guess it's because maybe she's not a bad guy, because usually Asta tends to think, like, hey, you're hurting him, I'm going to bring out my sword and stop it. Like, he doesn't do that. Maybe he's trying to, and he gets distracted running into Sol Marin's tits. Like, egregiously so.
Like, he is nose deep in that cleavage.
It's a moment where you're like, did she teleport in front of you, or did you just not realize that you were running headfirst into this woman's chest?
So, Sol dispatches Asta for trying to get in the way, and she's like, anyway, and she kind of ends up saving the guy that Charlotte is crushing because I found this really cool dress that you should change into, and drags her into some changing curtains and changes into this very ornamental dress. And immediately everyone's attention goes from the guy who's getting crushed to death to, oh, wow, you look so beautiful and cool. And all of the guys in the crowd are like, oh, she's hot. And then both of them immediately turn around like, no, you just don't look at her. The only ones allowed to get all excited about her looks are the Blue Rose Knights.
Giggity.
Yeah. Yami randomly shows up, and he's like, hey, Asta, you dumb brat. Are you having fun? And this is where the chapter gets a little weird, because some pages are clearly unfinished. It's not too bad because they're just, you know, pictures of people trading insults and talking with each other anyway. But it is odd that and very obtrusive to suddenly go, wow, sketches.
It's egregious in the one panel that's Vanessa and the night chick, like, looking at one another because there's no dialogue.
No background,
and they're not finished drawing. So it's like a panel where you're like, was this done, period? Like, was there supposed to be dialogue here?
I also like how you can see that Tabata had to draw the outlines of their tits in order to get just the contours on their clothing right.
I imagine it's probably because Tabata-sensei is working on the anime, and that's supposed to be coming out relatively soon, so probably just a busyness that came into that prompted this. This happened a couple weeks ago as well, as the same week My Hero had some issues. So it's, you know, certainly forgivable, but it definitely takes away a little bit from this chapter.
Vanessa shows up shortly after Yami does, and they both immediately are like, I have a rivalry with this woman now. Specifically because they both admire Yami, and they're like, I must defeat her. Because you know how women are, Chris.
Yeah, they're very catty about when someone else is after their man.
Yeah. That's the way that they have to, you know, that's the only time they have to establish dominance over each other. Preferably with mud wrestling or hair pulling.
I was going to say, if this is anything like WWE, they're going to have a Thanksgiving Day food fight, which takes place all in a pool filled with quote-unquote gravy. And then they should have like a Miller
Evening Girl Gown match.
Fight. Yeah, evening gown match. Playboy Bunny match, which I don't know if that really, like, I don't know what that meant. It had as much context as a non-sanctioned fight. Like, actually, I mean, the best, you know what? I know
was, that one ended with one of them getting thrown out of the ring, so I guess that's how you win it.
Now, Nick, I know we have very little time left. We should have time for tangents. What the fuck does a non-sanctioned fight mean in a WWE? Because I watched WrestleMania, and there was a referee for that match.
I don't
and
know.
And a pinfall. I was like, some force didn't sanction this, but apparently sanctioning, like not being sanctioned still means you get a referee, a timekeeper, the ring, everything else. Like, what does sanctioning in the WWE actually mean?
I've been doing that for years. Like, Shawn Michaels versus Triple H when Michaels came back was an unsanctioned street fight, and that had a pinfall.
Yeah, so it's like, what does non-sanctioned mean? All right, back to the chapter.
So they decide that they're going to have a drinking contest. And, which is brought up because Vanessa literally just like sees that someone is serving beer. And she's like, Captain, you like girls who can hold their liquor, right? And I was like, yeah, I guess.
Sure, I suppose. He's like, they're okay, I guess. And she's like, got it! I admit, this is actually a very funny chapter because I love that they have this drinking contest and essentially they both have like these great like finishes to it. Like Vanessa loses not because she can't hold her liquor. It's because she's been fucking drinking all day already. So she has like one drink and she's like, ah, oh, shit, too much.
So Charlotte's like, ah, if she's already had a ton of drinks, I can win this.
She takes a sip and she's just fucking blottoed at that point. She's like,
I like how the cat is also passed out of Vanessa's head.
Your cat was like, yeah, it's been a rough night.
Charlotte is like, what am I doing? Why am I acting this way? And we get her backstory, which is that she was cursed. When she turns 18, it will activate a curse that will engulf you all and trap you within a cage of time. So she tried to become stronger and use her own personal strength to overcome the curse. Trained very hard, established herself within the Blue Rose Knights, got a great reputation. But the curse set off when she turned 18, and she couldn't do anything against it. She was trying to stop it herself, but nothing was working. So when she was basically about to accept her own death while apologizing to her mother and father, suddenly Yami showed up and was just like, hey, I was eating pasta soup and you suddenly flung it all over the place. So what are you going to do about that now, huh? You going to apologize? What's wrong with you?
Yami is an amazing character in that I feel like he just doesn't want to be in this world and he just happens to be the strongest dude in it. Like, he's just like, hey, I was fucking trying to eat. So could you stop with your fucking story and motivation and shit and just let me get back to eating? And all the other characters, like, he's the most amazing person. And he's like, I would be so happy if other people weren't around. They could stop bothering me with their nonsense.
They established that they know each other kind of well enough since they both joined the Magic Knights at roughly the same time. And Sayami says, like, hey, you know, you're always so calm and collected when you're on missions. You're really not acting that way now. I like tough girls, but you could ask people for help once in a while, yeah? And, so Charlotte's reaction to this was, that was the way to break the curse. To have your heart stolen by a man.
Wait, hold on a moment. I missed this line when reading it. That shit's stupid as shit.
That's bullshit.
That's ridiculous. That was the way
that's
to break
fucking
the curse.
Stupid.
I guess it was that what Sleeping Beauty was? That she had to be?
That was basically what Bella, that was basically what the plot of Beauty and the Beast was, just, you know, with the genders reversed. Well, specifically, the curse of Beauty and the Beast was, it shall be broken when you can learn to love someone and be loved in return.
Yeah, which actually works. It's a way of showing someone stops being selfish, but wasn't Sleeping Beauty was be the kiss of a prince, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So this is similar in that, but it's just like to have
you gotta have the hots for someone.
Yeah, that's essentially it. Like, girl, you gotta fucking, cause what if it was like, what if she's like, no, I'm a lesbian. I don't, like, I just don't find dudes sexually attractive in any way.
Sexist fucking curse?
Yeah, what the fuck? Let's go find that fucking, that shitty sexist.
That fucking douchebag homophobic asshole who cursed her. What if she, and hey, what if she, what if she's asexual?
Yeah, alright, you know what? She's not the, conform to your sexual identity.
Don't impose your own. Oh man, you better get barefoot and pregnant if you don't want your thorn vines to kill everyone. Spread your legs, honey.
This is such a weird contingency to put on this. Like, if you met that witch now, you'd be like, what, are you not even woke? This old century values you have? She can love anyone she wants and break that curse.
It's not even that. It's the fact that it's so, like, you have to fall in love with someone.
It wasn't like she learned a lesson. She didn't learn a lesson. It was like...
You just gotta have the hots with somebody. I guess it's nice that that someone that was your type happened to show up.
Yeah, there's no Disney moral in this. It's not like at the end of this, she's like, wow, how cruel I've been to men. It's like, no, her hatred of men kinda comes from her own curse, apparently.
Oh gosh, be strangled by thorny vines that you can't control, or gush your panties over somebody.
Yeah, you got one or two, alright? Pick one. Man, I don't know how I missed that the first time.
Imagine if, like, the conditions of that were reversed, like, you will be cursed so that your flames will shoot out of your eyeballs and destroy everyone that you care about, unless you pop a boner over a chick.
I'm like, oh, so, like...
Oh, no problem whatsoever.
I'm like,
I fall in love with, like, every new girl I meet since I was 12.
I'm like, so this is like a Cyclops power, essentially, but, like, instead of ruby quartz, I just have to pop a boner for a chick? That's fine. Can I just have a picture of Anna Kendrick stapled in front of my forehead? Because that'll essentially be the same thing as the ruby quartz lens.
Oh, man.
Can I just have a revolving set of photos of Alexa Bliss for the WWE going on? Because then no one's going to have to worry about these fire eyes.
Anyway, so the chapter ends with everyone being like, hey, it's time for the Magic Knight Brigade Achievement Ceremony. The new Crimson Lion Kings and Purple Orcas captains are going to be there, too. That's the end.
I wonder if all the captains are motivated in life by really weird, objectively non-helpful curses that were placed on them.
Turns out that the Dawn Knights captain is just like, I gained these scars one day, but by a curse, and the only way to prevent the curse from spreading is to fall in love with someone.
I would lose the curse if I decided to just, I don't know, have someone give me charity for some reason. Like, it's just this weird curse. It's like, what is this meant to do? Like, usually people get curses placed on them. Like, that's what the Disney movie is. Like, if a curse gets placed on a character, it's because, like, either you or your parents were shitty people, and this is meant to teach you a lesson. Like, it's like, that's what, like, witches always do. They're like, you're shitty to me when I looked ugly, so I place a curse on you because you're selfish. But this one, it's like, I place a curse on your daughter that she should be fine if she has a working libido and is an attraction to men, I guess. But otherwise, I guess she kills everybody. Take that!
So, and they established that the reason that for her, like, hating men aside from Yami in this chapter also is that the sort of person who can't defeat me could never accept my curse. They're all weak men, all just talk. So I'll do something about it on my own. So, I mean, not actually a very logical approach to things, because just because someone is not actually, you know, more powerful than you does not mean that they would not be willing to accept some sort of issue that you have. But, in fairness, she has been raised this way for where she was just kind of like, you know, she was afraid that everyone was going to be killed by her, and knew that since she was a child. So, hormonal teenagers are also not the smartest people in the world. So the fact that she was influenced this way is understandable, even if she was completely fucking wrong. So
question. If she were, like, say Yami were to die, or he, like, did something that she stopped being, having her heart stolen by him, would the, like, thorns then presumably activate again and, like, go out of control again? Like, is it, like, the curse broken now? Or, it says the way to break the curse is to have it, but...
Yeah, it says that a curse is broken. I guess it is possible that that could be a consequence of that happening. But I don't know. It's, I would lean towards probably not.
Man, I fucking, I don't know how I missed it. Black Clover is like winning itself over week to week to me for just like unintentional comedic value. There's the fucking curse that just makes no sense. There's the random mind controlling to just make things better in the world. This shit is great.
So, that is it for Black Clover. Alright, I feel a lot better about the character of Charlotte now than I did before. At least there is like a reasoning that does make some degree of sense with her. And it feels like she could be a bit more entertaining in the future, too. So, let's move on to chapter 861 of One Piece, veteran actor of, it's more of the wedding and the plan to kill Big Mom going on here. So, God, I don't even remember all this stuff very well.
Especially,
so,
we really don't have a whole
Capone's
lot of time.
Capone's group is like actually starting to just discuss their plan to kill the general, keep the generals at bay and kill Big Mom and stuff. The fucking door that has the face on it is observing things while this is going on. And eventually it's like, I must warn Big Mom. So they cut its face off.
Kill the shit out of it.
Jesus Christ. I get to see the image of Mother Carmel that is brought before Big Mom. She's, it's like, oh yes, our mother is here, you're looking so pleasant, yeah. And so this, some guy is just like, hey, I'm a first time guest at the tea party, just, who is this woman? Like, how dare you pry into my precious memories? Never mind. She brings attention to the tomate box, saying that she wants to open it, after the ceremony, so. It's nice that that's being brought back as well. It's cool. Caesar Clown shows up, popping out of Capone's fortress body. He's got the big old mirror ready. He's posing against it, trying to look badass as well, you know, with his suit, arm propped up, hand in his pocket. The door catches on. It's like, I must warn someone. Slices the face off. That happens. Capone pops his head inside of his body to shout at the Straw Hats, who, except for Jinbei, are all passed out. Fucking, what's her name?
Nami?
No.
Brulé.
Brulé. She and the train guy are also passed out in the background. That's funny. And Capone's like, why are you guys dozing instead of getting ready? And Jinbei's like, come on, they haven't had much rest since they first got here, so go easy on them. Capone gets Caesar Clown to jump back inside. And, so we then cut to Sanji and Pudding. And Pudding is putting up, continuing to put up her act. He's like, oh, Sanji, And Sanji says, like, I can't believe we're actually here. It's like I'm in a dream.
Is it a good dream or a bad dream?
And Sanji's like, she's planning to kill you, Sanji. Don't freak out. wants to kill you. So, hey, we're going to have to, you know, kiss. It's going to be embarrassing in front of all those people. Do you want me to just like, I guess I could just kiss you on the forehead.
No, you should kiss me on the lips if we're going to be husband and wife.
And Pudding is, you know, just like,
oh, my poor Sanji, why are you bleeding from the nose?
Oh man, this perverted clown, God, I want to fucking kill him so badly.
I hate this guy so much.
We cut to the party where Big Mom is drinking and celebrating with a bunch of her guests, and then this MC basically shows up and says, oh yes, and here is, we have the 35th daughter, Pudding, and the third son of the Vince family, Sanji. We are going to unite them together, and here they come! They're flown in on this, what's his face? The cloud thing that, Big Mom has. And they're cartoonishly, altering the, you know, we are gathered here today kind of speech with, you know, like, they shall now be joined in wicked alliance with these two young souls, mariage de raison. The bonding of this pair shall bring life to a brand new blooming evil.
A round of applause.
Sanji's got this big dopey grin on his face, and Capone's like, man, this guy's selling it. What an actor. And that's it. honestly, not an especially eventful chapter. But things are really kicking into motion, which of course means that One Piece is off next week because, yeah.
It is what it is. But yeah, good chapter. Let's wrap up here, I think.
All right. So, favorite chapter this week? Gosh. Actually, I have to think a little bit about this.
I want to give mine to My Hero Academia. So, I think it was probably the best of this week. There wasn't a tremendous amount of great chapters this week. As I said, I'm still kind of on the fence on whether or not The Promised Neverland is going to be a good chapter or not. I think time will tell with that one, but
yeah.
Of this week, I think that was probably my favorite, at least of like just gaining enjoyment out of me.
I'm going to kind of cheat, and I'm going to say Astro Lost in Space.
That works. No, you can absolutely.
Yeah. Some nice emotional moments between the cast, a new challenge for them to overcome, and a big twist at the end. So there you go. Favorite character, I've thought about giving it to a number of different characters, but I'm going to give it to Ishiki because, just for that one lone moment of him slicing the eel open was so fucking badass looking. But, on top of that also, you know, him goofing around and then getting serious when the Polaris Storm was insulted.
Cool. No, I completely agree. I'm absolutely going with that as well. It's going to be, pretty exciting, moment to see what Ishiki does from here. This is the first time I've been really pumped for him. So I think it's good.
And I can't access the results of the poll.
Promise Neverland won for the audience poll or at Hitbox.
It wouldn't let me click one of the choices.
It's actually a very significant victory margin for it as well, too. So a lot of people really enjoyed Promise Neverland this week.
All right. So that's going to do it for us here on Weekly Manga Recap. Thank you guys for joining us. We record the show each Wednesday, usually at about 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on hitbox.tv/RoloT as well as twitch.tv/RoloT. Sometimes we do need to change things up, so you can follow us on social media to stay updated on things. The official Twitter account for the show is @WMRPodcast, and your hosts are @RoloT and @YRollerOfTime. You can check out our past episodes in a number of different places, including weeklymangarecap.podbean.com as well as our YouTube channel and on iTunes. And make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a comment and ring so that you can help us out with the algorithm to defeat the woodworkers in the hobby section.
Someone has to bring them down a notch, Nick.
Hell yeah.
They're becoming too powerful.
Indeed. Send us criticism, ask us questions, suggest future manga for us to read, and send all that stuff by email to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. And, special thanks also go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy.
Yes, special thanks, by the way, to Lindbergh and Arn Menz. It is greatly appreciated. Boosh, fist bump.
And finally, special thanks go out to the guys who helped us make the podcast what it is. Steve Mann, our talk artist, who was... I mean, of course he fucking drew that character. I mean,
it wasn't a tough one to figure out. He's like, who am I going to draw this week? Oh, there's a giant giant-titted character.
And she wears a bikini everywhere. All right, got it. Infamous Planet, of course, also makes the frame around us on our video stream. That's going to do it, guys. Yes. Do we have a suggestion for...
No, I'll tell you guys later. I didn't have the time to make it this week, so that's going to do it.
Bye.
Bye.